From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
In other words, without your study alleging liberal bias in PBS programming, people wouldn't have noticed it? Is that what you're saying?
I didn't need a study to document that the mortgage program was biased.
Then why did you pay Frederick Mann 14,000 taxpayers?
For CPB Chief Kenneth Tomlinson comes under fire from a Senate panel for his decision to secretly monitor the political content of public television and radio programs. We'll play excerpts of the hearing and have a debate. Then, as more evidence emerges of Karl Rove's role in the outing of an undercover CIA operative, the White House grows increasingly quiet.
No one wants to get to the bottom of it more than the President of the United States. And we're just not going to have more to say on it until that investigation is complete.
We'll speak with Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman, as well as journalist David Korn. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Washington, calls are intensifying for President Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove, to resign because of his role in the outing of an undercover CIA operative. For nearly 2 years, the White House has denied Rove had any part in the leak. But on Sunday, Newsweek revealed Rove personally spoke with a reporter from Time magazine about the agent, Valerie Plame, although he did not state her name. On Monday, White House Press spokesperson Scott McClellan refused to answer questions about Rove, claiming it would be premature to do so since the investigation's ongoing. But 2 years ago, when allegations about Rove first emerged, the White House repeatedly denied he played any role in the leak. In September of that year, McClellan told reporters he'd spoken personally with Rove and that it was, quote, simply not true that Rove had any role in the leak. As for the president, he's repeatedly said he would fire anyone involved in the leak of classified information. On Monday, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said, quote, I trust they'll follow through on this pledge. In London, the official death toll from last week's bombings is now 52. Earlier today, police announced they'd searched five residential homes in West Yorkshire and northeast England in connection with the bombings. Investigators now believe the bombs were made by a single bomb maker using military-grade explosives. On Monday, President Bush vowed to keep waging the so-called war on terror.
There's only one course of action. We will continue to take the fight to the enemy, and we will fight until this enemy is defeated.
Meanwhile, a new CNN poll has found a majority of Americans now believe the war in Iraq has made the United States less safe. The percentage of respondents who felt this way jumped from 39% to 54% following the bombings in London. Just 40% of Americans believe the war in Iraq has made the country safer. In Iraq, Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has launched a petition drive calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the country. Sadr seeking to collect 1 million signatures this week. 400,000 people have already signed the petition, which will be submitted to the Iraqi government and the United Nations. The petition reads, quote, I hereby declare my rejection of the forces of occupation and demand their withdrawal. In other Iraq war news, a federal judge has ruled two whistleblowers who allege their former employer cheated taxpayers out of tens of millions of dollars on reconstruction projects in Iraq can go ahead with their lawsuit. The whistleblowers are former employees of Custer Battles. In Lebanon, the country's outgoing defense minister has survived an attack on his motorcade while it drove through an affluent suburb of Beirut. The minister, Elias Murr, was taken to the hospital with minor wounds. At least two people died in the car bombing. Murr is the son-in-law of pro-Syrian President Emil Lahoud. On Monday, the world community marked the 10th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre. 8,000 Muslim men and boys were slaughtered by Bosnian Serbs. The killing marked Europe's worst atrocity since World War II. The Muslims were massacred after being taken from what was supposed to be a UN-protected safe area. Mark Brown, special envoy of Kofi Annan, read a personal message from the Secretary General.
We cannot evade our own share of responsibility. As I wrote in my report in 1999, we made serious errors of judgment, rooted in a philosophy of impartiality and nonviolence, which, however admirable, was unsuited to the conflict in Bosnia. That is why, as I also wrote, the tragedy of Srebrenica will haunt the UN history forever.
The alleged perpetrator is wartime Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and his military commander Ratko Mladic have been indicted for genocide by the UN Tribunal at The Hague, but remain at large somewhere in the former Yugoslavia. Back home in this country, the U.S. Supreme Court granted a last-minute stay of execution Monday for a man from Virginia who was scheduled to be executed at 9 o'clock last night. Attorneys for Robin Lovett requested his murder conviction be reviewed after a court clerk destroyed key evidence, making additional DNA testing impossible. A coalition of 12 environmental and activist groups are calling for a boycott of ExxonMobil. The groups are aiming to brand the oil giant as an outlaw company for refusing to acknowledge the existence of global warming, as well as the company's support for oil and gas exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Groups involved include the Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and the U.S. Public Interest Group. And finally, another official involved in the Iran-Contra scandals back in the news. The Los Angeles Times is reporting that Robert Earle is now serving in one of the most coveted offices of the Pentagon, as Chief of Staff to Gordon England, Acting Deputy Secretary of Defense. In 87, Earle admitted to a grand jury he'd destroyed and stolen national security documents while working for Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North during the Iran-Contra scandal. He was never prosecuted. The Los Angeles Times reports in his new position, Earle has clearance to review the kinds of classified documents he once destroyed. Several other key players in the Iran-Contra affair, including Elliot Abrams and John Poindexter, have played key roles in the current Bush administration. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Kenneth Tomlinson, came under fire from a Senate panel Monday for his decision to secretly monitor public television and radio programs and about other controversial moves that have led to calls for his resignation. The nearly two-hour exchange was the first time Tomlinson was directly questioned about recent allegations regarding his 22-month tenure as chair. Republican Senator of Pennsylvania Arlen Specter scheduled the hearing to discuss funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which provides federal money to public broadcasters. Under its mandate from Congress, the CPB is required to act as an independent buffer between lawmakers and public broadcasters. But under Tomlinson's leadership, accusations have grown of an increasing politicization at CPB. Last year, Tomlinson secretly paid more than $14,000 to an outside consultant to monitor the political content of the guests on the PBS program Now with Bill Moyers. The consultant, Fred Mann, worked for the American Conservative Union for many years. Mann also monitored National Public Radio's Diane Rehm show and the PBS talk shows Tucker Carlson Unfiltered and Tavis Smiley. Politicians and journalists who expressed opinions critical of the Bush administration were dubbed liberal or anti-Bush. NPR has reported they had obtained emails from a CPB official that showed that Tomlinson had conferred with the White House in hiring decisions and in shaping policy at the corporation. His most recent hire is Patricia Harrison, who began her job as chief executive of CPB last week. Harrison is currently was a high-ranking official at the State Department. She was co-chair of the Republican National Committee from 1997 to January 2001, helping to raise money for Republican candidates, including George W. Bush. In her first public appearance since she began the job last week, Harrison sought to assure the subcommittee her partisan background would not affect her performance as CEO. She said, quote, "I feel confident I'm a fair person, that I have a great deal of integrity, and that nobody owns me ever." PBS President Pat Mitchell and John Lawson, president of the Association of Public Television Stations, also testified at Monday's hearing, along with David Bowes of the libertarian Cato Institute. The sharpest questioning of Tomlinson came from Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate. He was one of 16 senators who signed a letter calling on Tomlinson to resign. This is an excerpt of the exchange between Durbin and Tomlinson.
This is an issue on the minds of a lot of people. What's happening to public broadcasting? Are we going through some effort now to politicize this, to change the nature and philosophy of something that we value very much in this country? I'm a fan, have been for a long time. Obviously, I'm not alone. When you read the surveys of people asking them what they think about public broadcasting, it's pretty good. Over 1,000 adults polled, PBS and NPR had an 80% favorable rating. Not a single one of us on this side of the panel would look askance at that number. 80% favorable is pretty good. And when you ask if it's fair and balanced, not to steal a line from some other company, 55% said PBS programming is. 79% said NPR is fair and balanced. And that's why it strikes me as odd, Mr. Tomlinson, that we are on this crusade of a sort here, this mission to change what's going on. I don't quite get it, understand what your agenda is here and what you're trying to achieve. I read and I watched over the break Mr. Moyer's speech in St. Louis, ordered a copy online, read it twice. It's troubling to me. I think Bill Moyer's program now was a balanced program, and I think most people would agree with it. Now, Mr. Mann, that you hired, or someone hired, to monitor this program, came up with some rather strange conclusions about who's a liberal and who's a conservative and who's a friend of the president and who isn't. And it you know, even I think in your opening statement, you have tried to clarify that you don't stand by his conclusions. So, for example, on Senator Hagel, characterization of Senator Hagel as liberal and such, maybe you do think he's a liberal, and I don't know what that conclusion might be. But the point I'd like to get to is this. Let's go to a specific question. Under Section 19 of Public Broadcasting Act, you're required to mandate political balance on all shows. It's been reported that you have championed the addition of Wall Street Journal editorial report to the PBS lineup and that you've raised money for that purpose. I'd like you to clarify, if you did that, how much money was raised, what was your purpose in bringing in the Wall Street Journal, which has been noted is a publication owned by a company that's been very profitable and wouldn't appear to need a subsidy to put on a show.
I think Senator Stevens hit the nail on the head. No bias. No bias from the left, no bias from the right. If we have programs like the Moyer's program that tilt clearly to the left, then I think according to the law, we need to have a program that goes along with it that tilts to the right and let the people decide.
Let me ask you about this clearly to the left bias on the Moyer's show. How did you reach that conclusion? Did you watch a lot of those shows?
I watched a lot of those shows, and I think Mr. Mann's research demonstrates that the program was clearly liberal advocacy journalism. It was good broadcasting. Bill Moyers is a very capable broadcaster, but it seems to me we should be able to agree that we don't want bias, and if we do, in the interest of provoking debate, if we have some bias on public television, this balance it out in the course of the evening.
So what was Mr. Mann's expertise? Why did you happen to hire him? According to Senator Dorgan, who's seen the raw data, he was paid thousands of dollars. His data, riddled with spelling errors, was faxed to you from a Hallmark store in downtown Indianapolis. What is this man's background for judging a program like Moyer's program and whether it's liberal or not?
Well, he worked for 20 years for the National Journalism Center, which is a 401c3 organization.
National Journalism Center?
National Journalism
what
Center.
What is that? I don't know.
But the point of watching...
Excuse me, what is a national journalism system?
It was a center here in Washington that found internships for...
And they're straight down the middle of the road, moderate, centrist group, right and left.
I think it was qualified for 401c3 support, but I think it was regarded as right of center.
His testimony.
But the point is, it's like Bob Dylan said, you don't need to wear the vane to see which way the wind's blowing. It was very clear that the Moyer's program was liberal advocacy journalism. I wanted a statistical basis because I didn't think people were responding appropriately. We got the statistical basis, and
From Mr. Mann?
From Mr. Mann's research. And as soon as we got the statistical basis, it turned out other people had determined that program should be balanced. It was balanced. All this took place something like a year and a half ago.
Well, I've got to get to the basic question here, and I won't go through the list of some of Mr. Moyer's more liberal guests, Frank Gaffney, Grover Norquist, Richard Viguerie, Paul Gigot, on his liberal program. Let me ask you this, if I can.
Yes, sir. Did
you feel that it was your responsibility or authority to go out and put together the Wall Street editorial page show and to find subsidy for that? Did you feel that that was your responsibility to do?
I felt that the law required us to reflect balance in our current affairs programming. Now, I was not the only one involved in encouraging a program that represented a diverse point of view from the Moyer Show.
So following Mr. Moyer's comments in St. Louis, can we expect you to do the same for The Nation magazine? Are you going to raise $5 million to make sure they have a show?
I don't see that today we have a balanced problem. We have a 30-minute show now, and we have a 30-minute show Wall Street Journal. That's balance. Let the people decide. Balance is common sense.
But Mr. Thomason, the people, I said at the outset, already decided. They thought that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was presenting balance. And they thought that, you know, they gave it a high approval rating. You have perceived a problem here, which the American people obviously don't perceive.
Well, certainly in terms of Jim Lehrer NewsHour, there is no balance problem. That is great journalism. Public broadcasting has a great reputation in these areas. We had a period of time 2 years ago where I think we were all asleep at the switch in terms of the mortgage programming. I never wanted to take the mortgage program off the hour.
And what do you mean by asleep at the switch with the Moyers program? I'd like you to tell me a little bit more.
Because we should have been aware that on Friday evening, if you presented liberal advocacy journalism for an hour, you really should present conservative advocacy journalism for an hour, just for a matter of balance. The law requires balance.
And this was your conclusion based on Mr. Mann's investigation?
Well, this was my conclusion when I found that there was a dispute over my view of this program and the general review of this program. I, quite frankly, have run into next to no serious people who regarded the Moyers program as anything other than good liberal advocacy program.
Will you accept his invitation to take an hour, go on the air on public television, to debate that issue?
Well, absolutely, but you know...
Oh, you will accept it?
Oh, absolutely, but you know, Senator Durbin, Bill Moyers and I both have concluded that this debate is not good for public television.
No, it isn't.
You know, there were things that Moyers said in that speech about me that were most inaccurate and unfair. And it saddened me to see that. I could have come back in kind. I chose not to. We're for public broadcasting. We're for no bias in public broadcasting. We don't want bias on the right, and we don't want bias on the left.
Kenneth Tomlinson, head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. He's chair of CPB, being questioned by Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois at Monday's Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. We're joined right now on the phone by Ernest Wilson. He is a board member of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, first appointed by President Clinton, like Tomlinson, in September of 2000 and reappointed by George W. Bush in November of 2004. Professor Wilson teaches government and politics and Afro-American studies at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Maryland. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you. Can you respond to the questioning you have just been listening to from yesterday's hearing?
Well, I think clearly we've been, there's been a huge amount of turmoil over the past 30 days or longer over the question of what's called objectivity and balance or bias. I attended the hearing yesterday that was chaired by Senator Spector, and person after person pointed out just the following facts, and here I just want to put this down on the record, that when you compare public broadcasting to all other institutions in American society, the judiciary, the executive, even the legislative branch of government, by a big majority, Americans find that they get huge value from public broadcasting and is by far their preferred institution. When you ask Americans to compare public broadcasting with private broadcasting, CNN, Fox, et cetera, by far most Americans believe that public broadcasting is more objective and balanced than private broadcasting. And we could go on and on with the opinion of teachers and the opinion of other viewers. So I think that the whole issue of objectivity and balance is way, way out of proportion, has been blown out of proportion over the past month or so. And unfortunately, as a consequence of this, most of the members of the public broadcasting station or community, NPR, PBS, local stations, have been critical of what the CPB has done. And so I think that that the whole question of objectivity and balance has been blown way out of proportion.
Professor Wilson, can you talk about the poll that the chair, Kenneth Tomlinson of CPB, had commissioned? Did you know about it? Was it put out publicly?
No, the board did not know about that poll. It has been said in the press again and again, and it is I'm concerned about that. Does the chair have the authority to do this? Perhaps has the chair done this in the past or other chairs? I don't know of any that have done this at all.
And what was the poll? What were the results of the poll that he, are you saying he suppressed this poll?
Well, I have never seen it to this day. I still have not seen it. And, you know, the question is not simply legality, but it's a question of, in fact, whether or not what the rest of the board is being shown is fair and balanced. I mean, if we're going to do these polls and the federal government's going to pay for them, then these are issues that need to be discussed before the board. And my concern, my big concern is that...
Yes.
And our other members of the family and within the board, that we have to enhance the transparency and openness with which these kinds of discussions proceed.
Professor Wilson, the issue of the paying of this Fred Mann of Indianapolis, more than $14,000 to monitor the political content of public radio and television shows, and listening to Senator Durbin saying the report was faxed to him to Tomlinson from a Hallmark store in Indianapolis. Who's Fred Mann? Did you also approve this?
No, that did not come before the board. And again, you know, my view is that when these issues, if you have routine things, and there's certainly things that the chief executive officer or the chair can do, but for matters that are clearly of a sensitive nature, that go to the very core of what it means to be public broadcasting, these are issues that should be more widely shared on the board and in the broader public. On the question of fairness and balance or objectivity and balance, you know, I would say, and we have to be, you know, politically realistic here. If, you know, a bunch of your appropriators and authorizers say that we want to see something done on fairness and balance, then it's the fiduciary responsibility of the board to at least address that question. But my view now is that that has been done. We have ombudsmen have been appointed. This issue has been aired and discussed. And the point now would be to declare a success and move on to the other burning issues that confront public broadcasting, issues of lack of ethnic diversity, racial diversity in our public broadcasting system, the fact that we are losing market share on the television side, that new technologies and new platforms are challenging us, and that our revenue base is shaky. These are the issues that really demand the attention of the public broadcasting system and the legislature, and I think it's to those things that we should turn our attention.
We're talking to CPB board member Ernest Wilson. What about the hiring of Patricia Harrison to be the president of CPB, the former co-chair of the Republican National Committee from 97 to 2001? You're a board member. Did you vote for her?
Well, I have been on record as saying publicly that I have been I was disturbed by the way in which this search was conducted. This is not to say anything about Patricia Harrison, but it is to say that we shouldn't select anyone from a who has run one of the national political parties. I mean, I'm a Democrat, but it would not be appropriate to have the former co-chair of the Democratic National Committee be the CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is supposed to be a heat shield. Secondly, the way the search was conducted, it was, I think, rushed and hurried and done in 60 days, when usually these things take much longer, so that we can get a full vetting and we can get as many opportunities to look at as many diverse candidates as we possibly can. And so I'm on public record as saying I think both of those things were violated in the case of this search. Now, the reality is that she is currently the CEO, and so I think all of us in the public broadcasting system are going to have to judge her by her deeds and her words. She's a smart woman. She's very savvy. I think she did had a good performance yesterday at her first public hearing, and so I'm certainly anxious to work with her. And I think the way that we need to move forward is to concentrate on the real issues that are bedeviling public broadcasting these days. Mm.
Ernest Wilson, I want to thank you for being with us and hope we can continue this conversation with you on future broadcasts. Ernest Wilson, board member of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back with a debate on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the role of public media in a minute. Dalt McDermott here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman as we broadcast on more than 350 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR radio stations, low-power FM stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations on both TV satellite networks on Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on Channel 375 on DirecTV. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org, closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and our headlines are in Spanish at our website, democracynow.org. Well, we're going to continue our discussion about public broadcasting. Monday, Senate hearing scheduled to discuss funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which provides federal money to non-commercial broadcasters, including PBS. CPB survived a Republican-led effort last month in the House to cut $100 million from its budget. The House, however, did not include more than $100 million in funding for technological upgrades and PBS Ready to Learn program, which subsidizes children's educational programming and distributes learning materials. The public broadcasting system still faces a 25% reduction in federal funding next year. This week, the Senate Appropriations Committee will consider the CPB budget, including $146 million worth of programs. Public broadcasting officials hope to get reinstated. One witness at Monday's subcommittee hearing expressed support for doing away with federal funding altogether, David Bowes, executive vice president of the Cato Institute. He joins us on the phone right now from his home in Virginia. We're also joined in the Washington, D.C. studio by Jeff Chester, executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. And on the line from Missouri is Bill Reed, president of KCPT in Kansas City. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Dave Bowes. You, yesterday at the hearing, testified on behalf of the Cato Institute. Make your case here.
Well, the main case that I want to make is that I think it is inappropriate to have a government radio and television network. As I told the committee, we wouldn't want to have a federally funded, federally run newspaper. I don't think we should have federal networks. And I think part of the reason for that, well, the main reason is we want a marketplace of ideas in democracy. We want lots of voices, and I don't think the government should be subsidizing some voices at the exclusion of others.
Let's get a response to that from Bill Reed, president of a PBS station, KCPT, in Kansas City.
Yeah. Well, the fact is there isn't a government broadcasting network, and when the Public Broadcasting Act was passed in 1967, the Congress made sure that there would not be a government broadcasting network by taking several steps in that act. One, they created CPB as a private, nonprofit corporation, not a government agency. They charged CPB with the responsibility of providing a heat shield so that there would be no political interference with public broadcasting. They prohibited CPB from producing programs. And most important of all, they stipulated that CPB could not be in charge of the interconnection and the scheduling of programs shipped to the stations. And so in 1969, PBS was created for that responsibility. So the idea that there's some kind of government broadcasting network is a myth.
Well, that's a fine theory, but the fact is that it's taxpayers' money. We're taxing everybody in America, and we're giving it to broadcasting networks that inevitably have a political spin, a political perspective, and that, I think, is inappropriate in a democracy. We know that most government broadcasting networks around the world are mouthpieces for the government. I'm not suggesting that NPR and PBS are that, but they are groups, they are networks that have a particular point of view, and I think it's inappropriate for the government to be funding one point of view against another. You said there were all these protections. Imagine someone had suggested 10 years ago that the three major broadcast networks are moderately liberal in their orientation, and there ought to be a conservative network, and Rupert Murdoch stepped forward and said, I'll do one, but I'll need a subsidy. Well, I'm sure everybody on this program would have been outraged at the suggestion that the government give money to Fox but agree to keep hands off.
You know, I find it interesting.
Bill Reed of KCPT.
This one-note drum that keeps people keep beating that we're some kind of liberal network, when study after study with the American people have shown that they trust public broadcasting and They do not think that we're biased. And so, you know, we keep hearing these opinions from you and others that you don't have any facts to back them up.
I have plenty of facts to back them up. What you have is one fact, is that your bias is subtle enough that most of your viewers don't recognize it, and that's the most effective bias of all. I always think the conservatives would be more effective if they would learn to make their biases more subtle. But look, when the chief political correspondent of NPR says in a news report there's more than a little racism in opposition to President Clinton's economic programs, that strikes me as a pretty strong political statement. If you look at the way NPR covered the first year of the Clinton administration and the first year of the Bush administration, you find a strikingly more enthusiastic and favorable treatment of Clinton and his economic policy proposals. Can anybody seriously believe that PBS and NPR don't have a point of view that comes through in their coverage of issues like gay rights and gun control? Now, I happen to agree with that bias on some of the issues because I'm a libertarian, not a conservative, but I still recognize that my support for gay rights, which I share with the general ethos of PBS and NPR, is a partisan, well, not partisan, but a point of view, and not every American shares it, and not every American should be taxed to advance it.
I want to bring Jeff Chester into this conversation. We're talking to David Bowes, Executive Vice President of the Cato Institute, who testified before Congress yesterday, Bill Reed, President of the PBS station in Kansas City, KCPT, Jeff Chester, in the studio in Washington, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Jeff Chester.
Well, public broadcasting is vital to this country. Free of commercial pressures, it can provide the kind of news and public affairs and arts programming and community programming that is all too rare on American television today. We need to have an expanded public broadcasting system. For the last 2 years, Ken Tomlinson and his conservative backers have been engaged in a campaign to neuter, to change public broadcasting, and in particular to make sure that PBS doesn't air the kind of hard-hitting investigative programs that the American people really require. And indeed, yesterday, it was sad that no one came to the defense of the role that PBS must play in terms of investigative reporting. We need public broadcasting. And in terms of the Cato Institute's own board of directors, you've had Rupert Murdoch on there. Currently, you've had John Malone. You've had two high-level corporate media titans who have used their political power here in Washington to eliminate the ability to have a real diverse media system in broadcasting on cable. Your board members have used their political power to reduce the kinds of choices, to narrow the diversity. Your current board member, John Malone, has done more to undermine the potential of cable television to offer diverse programming. He's even stopped in the past a news channel from appearing during his career. But what we need to do is to remove Ken Tomlinson from the board. Mr. Tomlinson clearly misled Congress yesterday. He said that the poll was made public, and here is a copy of the poll. This poll was never even given to PBS. I'm holding up a copy of the poll that someone leaked to me. This poll was, PBS and NPR officials were never even allowed to take the poll out of the room of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So Mr. Tomlinson is misled. Congress. He is clearly using this bias canard as a cudgel to tell public broadcasting, don't do any serious, hard-hitting investigative programming.
Jeff Chester, since you have the poll in front of you, what is the title of the poll? What is the ultimate conclusion of this poll that Tomlinson commissioned but would not release?
Well, the fact of the matter is, Mr. Tomlinson commissioned an initial poll done primarily by a Republican polling firm, the Terrence Group, along with a Democratic polling firm, Lake, Snell, and Perry. He commissioned the first poll, and that poll showed that the overwhelming majority of the American public, as been reported, felt there wasn't a bias problem. Mr. Tomlinson was so dismayed by the first poll that he actually commissioned the second poll. And I have the National Public Opinion Survey number 2 here, which I'm holding up, and it's marked confidential. And what that poll showed, once again, was the overwhelming majority of the public have confidence in the programming on public television and public radio. They rely on it highly. And, you know, it's not surprising that an independent survey done in 2002 by the University of Maryland, 2003, about public perceptions about the war leading up to the Iraq War showed that those who watched public television or listened to public radio were the best informed about the various issues than any other medium in this country. So public broadcasting is essential.
David Bowes, I'd like to get your response, but I also wanted to read you something from today's Washington Post, headlined, "Two Big Thumbs Up for Public Radio TV, New Ombudsman Praise Programming." It says, "Is public broadcasting a nest of left-wing biases? Ken Tomlinson, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds public TV and radio, was so concerned about the alleged leftward drift of programs on NPR and PBS that the CPB chair persuaded his agency to hire not one but two ombudsmen to review and critique NPR and PBS news segments. So what kind of slanted reporting have Ken Bode and William Schultz uncovered since they began work 3 months ago? Well, as it turns out, not much. Actually, as it turns out, none at all. Instead, Bode and Schultz have been positively glowing in their assessments of the journalism heard on NPR and seen on news shows distributed by PBS. So glowing, in fact, that Schultz and Bode's reports, which are posted on CPB's website, could easily be excerpted in the shorthand style of a movie ad quoting favorable reviews, to wit, first-rate, insightful interviews, and all two excellent reports. Excellent, informative. These two reports have a nuanced and balanced view of the situation." And these ombudsmen that were hired come from Reader's Digest, come from NBC. Your response to this?
Well, nobody would suggest that there aren't good reports on NPR and PBS, and certainly I could make the same kinds of statements about lots of the reports. I don't think that means that there isn't an overall tilt in the direction, in the kinds of things that are covered, in the choice of subjects, in the perspective. Maybe we're all conceding that now with Bill Moyers is left liberal advocacy, and so I don't have to go into that, but certainly that would be one example. Jeff was talking about a former board member.
Let me interrupt there. Well, Bill Reed, president of KCPT, would you agree with... No, let me just get a response to that, because you're giving...
I'd like to respond to what Jeff said about the Cato Institute, which I think was unfair.
Okay, you can do that. Just let's get Bill Reed's response on the Bill Moyers program. All then we'll go back to your point on Cato and John Malone.
My response to what?
The issue of we all agree that that Bill Moyers' program was left advocacy journalism.
Look, Bill Moyers has retired. I find it amusing that Mr. Tomlinson and now Mr. Bowes continually use Bill Moyers as the whipping boy for liberalism and public broadcasting. Bill Moyers is a great journalist. If he's liberal, so what? We had William Buckley on for 30 years on public broadcasting, the leading conservative in this country. We have John McLaughlin on, Tony Blankley every week, Pat Buchanan expressing their views. What's wrong with that? Over time, the idea is that we want to have all voices on public television.
David Bowes, your point on the Cato Institute board, Mayor John Malone.
Well, Jeff talked about a former board member, Rupert Murdoch, and a current board member, John Malone, and I'm not sure exactly what the point was, because I certainly don't get my ideas from them. But he did say they have tried to limit diversity in the media, and I think that's just silly. Rupert Murdoch created an alternative network. Remember the era of three major networks? Murdoch created a fourth, and it has a different perspective. And I don't have to like Fox News, but I think it's good that there's diversity on the air. And John Malone, in addition to having funded 100 networks, helped to create C-SPAN, and surely nobody's arguing that C-SPAN hasn't brought diversity and public affairs programming to television.
Jeff Chester.
Can I respond? Look, Bill Moyers did do commentaries, which one could label perhaps as liberal. I would see them as journalistic, but what people are forgetting is that the Moyers Show contains some of the best investigative and hard-hitting programming available on American television today. What we want to see is more of that kind of programming appearing on public television and certainly on public radio in the future. And it's that hard-hitting journalism. They're labeling it as liberal advocacy. What it really is hard-hitting investigative reporting. And they don't want to see that kind of programming. Now, we can debate about Cato and Murdoch and Malone, but that's not the point at the moment. I'm happy to. But we have to ensure that this attack on the ability of public television in particular to engage in serious journalism is rebuffed. And that's why I hope that, you know, your listeners will join with Free Press and Common Cause and other groups trying to reform public broadcast.
Yes, Bill I know Reed that all the left-wing groups are very David enthusiastic Bowes. About keeping PBS and NPR alive.
Bill Reed of KCPT, I want to just ask something very specific to what's happening this week, the Senate Appropriations Committee voting on whether to cut funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, not as far as David Bowes is saying of Cato Institute that it should be zeroed out. What would this mean for your station in Kansas City and for other stations? Can they survive without a Corporation for Public Broadcasting or even with the cuts that are being talked about now around 25%?
No, look. Mr. Bowes yesterday said that, well, it's only 15%, so we can do without that money. That he doesn't understand how delicately balanced the funding for public broadcasting is. Very quickly, here in Kansas City, we raise money in a variety of ways. We have auctions, we have special events, we have memberships, we have pledge drives, we sell some of our services, we lease some of our facilities. We get some small state support, and we get some support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting provides very, very important support by the way of community service grants to public broadcasting stations. It is not a straight 15%. KCPT receives about 12% of its budget in a community service grant. But the important fact here is that small stations in the United States receive 30, 40, 50% or more of their operating budgets through these community service grants. If those grants go down, those small stations go down. Those small stations in the aggregate pay a lot of money to PBS for our national program schedule. Once that money starts going away, you have a chain reaction that starts to happen in this country. And public broadcasting indeed would be in peril if these cuts were really made as we heard them proposed a couple of months ago.
Finally, David Bowes, are you for the cutting of funding, for example, to Voice of America?
Well, I think Voice of America is a different issue. Voice of America is part of American foreign policy, and I think there are pros and cons to having that. But, you know, one of the rules about Voice of America has always been that to avoid political propaganda in the United States, you could not show Voice of America programs in the United States. And over the years, there have been frustrations when it was rumored that Voice of America had done a wonderful program on the Czech Revolution or something, but it couldn't be shown here. So that's an attempt to say that to the extent the government produces broadcasting, we don't show it in our country. It's only part of our foreign policy overseas. So I think it's a separate issue.
David Bowes, I want to thank you for being with us, Vice President of Cato Institute, Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy, and Bill Reed, President of KCPT in Kansas City. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about Karl Rove. Stay with us.
Can it fail? No, can it fail?
Music by Horace Andy here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A growing number of Congress members are calling on President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, to resign if he won't publicly explain his role in the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. This comes as multiple media outlets continue to piece together various parts of the story and the extent of Rove's involvement. Newsweek obtained an email from Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper confirming Rove spoke with Cooper about Plame days before her name first appeared in a column by Robert Novak. Rove's attorney has now admitted that his client mentioned to Cooper Wilson's wife worked for the CIA, but claims Rove did not reveal her name. It's a felony to knowingly reveal the identity of an undercover operative. From the moment this scandal began, the White House has adamantly denied Rove or any other administration official was behind the outing of Plame. On Monday at the White House press briefing, spokesperson Scott McClellan was asked repeatedly about Rove's role. Among those questioning McClellan was Nation magazine reporter David Korn.
And now I'll go back to David. Go ahead.
There's a difference between commenting publicly on an action and taking action in response to it. Newsweek put out a story, an email saying that Karl Rove passed national security information onto a reporter that outed a CIA officer. Now, are you saying that the president is not taking any action in response to that? Because I presume that the prosecutor did not ask you not to take action, and that if you did, you still would not necessarily abide by that, that the president is free to respond to news reports regardless of whether there's an investigation or not. So are you saying that he's not going to do anything about this until the investigation is fully over and done with?
Well, I think the president has previously spoken to this. This continues to be an ongoing criminal investigation. No one wants to get to the bottom of it more than the president of the United States. And we're just not going to have more to say on it until that investigation is complete.
But you acknowledge that he is free as president of the United States to take whatever action he wants to in response to a credible report that a member of his staff leaked information. He is free to take action if he wants to.
Again, you're asking questions relating to an ongoing investigation, and I think I've responded to it.
White House spokesperson Scott McClellan speaking Monday at the daily news briefing at the White House. Meanwhile, California Democrat Henry Waxman's calling for congressional hearings, saying, quote, the new disclosures also raise issues about whether Rove acted alone or whether there was a conspiracy with other White House staff to use classified information for political purpose of discrediting. Plame's husband, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, exposed one of the Bush administration's key justifications for the invasion, Iraq's alleged attempt to purchase uranium from Niger. And he says that this whole thing is in retaliation for him speaking out. We turn now to Congressmember Waxman. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
Can you talk about your call right now? What is your demand?
I think that the Congress must hold hearings. Bring Karl Rove in, put him under oath, and let him explain the situation from his point of view. Let him tell us what happened. It's ridiculous that Congress should stay out of all of this and not hold hearings. You can imagine that if this had happened under the Clinton administration, there would have been many hearings by now. I asked Chairman Tom Davis, who's chairman of the Government Reform Committee, which is the chief investigative committee, to hold hearings in 2003. He said he wanted to wait to see what the Justice Department came up with. I just find that with the White House saying they want to wait for the Justice Department, with the Congress saying it, it's all stonewalling to me. They just don't want to get to the facts.
Can you talk about what you see as the crime here? How serious is this?
Well, to explain how serious it is, I want to quote the president's father, George H.W. Bush, because in April 1999, he was talking about how we need human intelligence. We need to give protections for those people who are gathering that intelligence. And he said, I have nothing but contempt and anger for those who betray the trust by exposing the name of our sources. They are, in my view, the most insidious of traitors. Now, that's what the president's father called those who would have leaked the information about Valerie Plame, who was working on finding weapons of mass destruction as a covert agent for the CIA. They outed her in order to, for political reasons, to get back at her husband. And the issues are, did Rove or others engage in such conduct, which would be a conspiracy? Did they find out about Valerie Plame through classified information, which they then used for political purposes, and then did they out her as a CIA agent? If those facts are true, even if they don't amount to a criminal offense, it just seems to me that Karl Rove has to resign. The president said he would fire anybody he found responsible for revealing this information. He obviously didn't care enough to get to the bottom of it by doing his own investigation of his own staff. But Congress has a constitutional responsibility to do it now.
David Corin, you were at the White House press briefing yesterday asking questions of Scott McClellan. You've been following this from the beginning. Can you talk about Scott McClellan's changes over the last 2 years and what he's willing to talk about and what he isn't?
Yes, I was asking questions and, like everybody else in the room, getting no answers. And it was very contentious yesterday. The mainstream media reporters really fired a lot of fastballs at Scott McClellan, maybe even not over the strike zone, but at his head, because of what he had said previously over and over again over the course of the last 2 years. He has said that it was ridiculous to suggest that Karl Rove was involved in this leak. And again, he quoted the president saying if anyone was involved in this leak, they would not want to be part of this administration. And so obviously the reporters came armed with all these quotes to the press briefing yesterday, and they kept asking Scott McClellan to stand by them. Was it true when you said that Karl Rove was not involved? Was it true when you said the president would act vigorously against anybody who was involved in such a leak? And again and again and again, he said, I'm not going to comment on this as part of an ongoing investigation. And they said, well, you used to comment on it all the time. And then he said, well, the special prosecutor asked us not to comment. Well, when did that happen? Well, after I made my previous comments. Oh, but then why was the president talking about it 9 months later? Was he, breaking the agreement with the special prosecutor? So his story did not hold, and you had people like David Gregory of NBC News literally shouting at Scott McClellan and saying, can you tell us that when you speak from the podium, you're telling us the truth or not? And he refused to answer that question. It got so ridiculous that even when Carl Cameron of Fox News said, does the president have confidence in Karl Rove? Scott McClellan said, I'm not going to answer that question. I mean, then somebody said, can you explain Karl Rove's importance to this administration? He said, I'm not going to answer that question. So it's quite clear to me, that, as the congressman said, they're engaging in a very classic maneuver. Stonewall, not say anything that would feed the story any further, hoping that the media will, be distracted by a Rehnquist resignation or something else, and they'll take a couple bad days of hits, and then if they don't put any more information out there, the story will fade, and they'll just keep walking past it.
David Corin of The Nation magazine questioning Scott McClellan yesterday at the White House. Your understanding of where the investigation stands right now, and also of one of your colleagues, Judith Miller, national security correspondent for The New York Times, being in jail as we speak?
Judith Miller is in jail because she would not cooperate with Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald. We don't quite know what he was after in her case, whether it was involves Karl Rove or anybody else. She didn't write a story, so it's clear that he saw a phone log, an email, got testimony from somebody else that led him to want to question her about what we don't know. As far as the investigation stands overall, at the hearing last week in which Matt Cooper, said he would talk to the grand jury. Fitzgerald said that after getting the material from Time magazine, it was more important than ever to talk to Matt Cooper. We didn't realize at the time that included the email that was revealed a couple of days ago about Karl Rove talking to Matt about Joe Wilson's wife being in the CIA. But it was clear to me from being at that hearing that Fitzgerald is not just sort of finishing up and dotting I's and crossing T's, but he still is vigorously trying to get to the bottom of this, and that his pursuit of Matt Cooper and Judith Miller was not just a vendetta or a prosecutor lashing out at reporters, but that he believed that he could get something to benefit his investigation by by winning their cooperation. And there are two legal issues. One is whether Karl Rove violated the Intelligence Identities Protection Act by identifying a covert officer. Another potential legal issue is whether Karl Rove or anybody else, when they testified before the grand jury, and we know that Rove testified a few times, told the truth. If Matt Cooper's email contradicts what Karl Rove might have told Fitzgerald or the grand jury about his conversation with Cooper, that would be the basis for a perjury charge. But I'm admitting here, this is highly speculative. We're just, you know, but we don't know because it's a secretive investigation.
Congressmember Waxman, are you calling for Karl Rove to resign?
I'm not calling for him to resign, although it looks like we're getting close to the point where he may have to resign. I think we need to get the facts, and I think that we need to hear from Karl Rove under oath in public. I don't think that this sort of thing ought to be done simply in secret. There could well be a report from the investigator, Mr. Fitzgerald, that would say he can't quite connect the dots to establish a crime or to be able to charge a crime, but that still wouldn't mean that Karl Rove should be allowed to continue. If he were involved in a conspiracy to use classified information for political purposes, even though they maybe didn't have the necessary intent to disclose it or whatever, just the action itself demeans their authority in the White House and shows the contempt they have for the protection of our sources at the CIA when Valerie Plame was working on trying to find weapons of mass destruction. They were interfering with that effort by outing her, and it's not just jeopardizing her, but jeopardizing her sources and those that she was working with. It's really a jeopardizing of our national security, and for that reason alone, whoever in the White House was involved in it should be forced out if not prosecuted.
You know, it's an important point, and the congressman knows this better than I do.
David Corn.
Not everything that's wrong in Washington is a crime. And so the White House is going to hide behind, as Karl Rove's lawyers hiding behind, the whole notion that he didn't technically commit a crime. But the bottom line was that we now know that he revealed national security information to a reporter while he was engaged in a political vendetta against a policy critic of the White House, Joe Wilson. And so either he knew what he was doing in revealing a covert officer, or he was reckless and cavalier about the whole matter and put politics ahead of that. Either one should be, you know, a firing offense, and at the very least, he should be called to explain. The president, as McClellan said yesterday, keeps saying he wants to get to the bottom of it. He wants to get to the bottom of it. It's very easy to get to the bottom of it. Put Karl Rove in front of cameras, have him swear to tell the truth, and tell the truth.
David Corn, I want to thank you for being with
us. He can't plead the fifth.
I want to thank you for being with us, David Corn of The Nation magazine, and Congressmember Henry Waxman. And we hope to have you back, Congressman, to talk about Halliburton in Iraq. But that does it for today's show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shrufo Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, and Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.